Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1040, interview number 9 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Trade. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2018. And once again, after a one-week interruption due to technical upgrades here at the station, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiEugenio, the author of, among other titles, Destiny Betrayed. Jim, welcome back to our airwaves.
Okay, nice to be here, Dave.
Well, we have taken 8 hours to warm up to the actual beginning of Jim Garrison's investigation. And I appreciate your indulgence with my long and very pedantic bent with this, but I think that the JFK assassination and Garrison's investigation of same really warrants this kind of deep dive, this sort of prolonged investigation. Now, we concluded our last interview by pointing out how utterly fallacious the, frankly, establishment lie about Garrison having done his investigation because he was ambitious was, and also that he began investigating the intelligence community and the CIA in order to cover up for his mafia pals. Garrison's actual investigation began right after November 22, 1963, and he got wind of David Ferry, and why don't you pick up the narrative at that point? Tell us about David Ferry, Garrison's interest in him, and we'll proceed from there.
All right. The lead from to David Ferry came in from a guy named Jack Martin, all right, who had worked out of Guy Bannister's office for a number of months, okay, prior to the JFK assassination, right? And on the day of the assassination, Bannister essentially pistol whipped Jack Martin because he thought he was trying to get into his files, all right, particularly the Oswald file, all right. And so a little bit angry about this, Martin started making some phone calls, and one of the phone calls was to an assistant prosecutor in Garrison's office named Herm Coleman, all right, and he said words of the effect that David Ferry was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's and that he taught him how to shoot in the Civil Air Patrol, right? And that Ferry was also one of the people in and out of Bannister's office that summer of 1963, and he had taken a mysterious trip, all right, to Texas, all right, on the day of the assassination. So, of course, Garrison was interested in that kind of info. I think any DA would be.
Sure.
You know? And so he started checking out the information. And it pretty much all checked out. And he actually went even beyond that. And he found out what that Ferry was supposed to be doing in Texas that day, all right, going to Galveston and Houston and sitting at a phone booth at a skating rink, all right, and then going to a hotel near Galveston, which happened to be right on the bay. I've actually been to that hotel. Called the Altamont Hotel. It sits right on Galveston Bay, right? And so, in other words, if you wanted to get somebody out by boat, you know, that would be the place to meet them, all right? So, anyway, Ferry heard that Garrison was looking for him, And he stayed at a college dorm until, and then so, which was north of New Orleans. And Garrison had his apartment staked out, all right, so he would know when he got back. And then when he did, he brought him in for questioning, all right? And to put it mildly, Garrison did not like the answers that he was getting from Ferry.
Develop that for us, if you would, Jim.
What?
Develop that for us, if
you
would.
Oh, okay, okay. For instance, he said that they decided to go goose hunting and ice skating, all right? But Garrison found out, well, Dave, how do you go goose hunting without shotguns? All right, because he had interviewed a couple of the guys in the car with Ferry and found out that they didn't bring any shotguns with them.
Maybe you hide in the Russes and throw your ice skates at the geese and bring them down that way.
And then he said, but Dave, I also found out, because I talked to the manager of the ice skating rink, that you never put any skates on. The whole time you were there, you know, you stood by a telephone, all right? And so, obviously, something was up here, all right? And so he turned him over to the FBI for some questioning, further questioning, which was a pretty bad mistake. But, of course, on that day, just a few days after the assassination, who could possibly figure what the heck was really going on, all right? If you remember, what was going on those days was this 24/7 coverage of the events in Dallas and then Kennedy's funeral and all that stuff. All right, nobody was really investigating anything what really happened, all right, except Jim Garrison. He was the only guy. And so what happens now, of course, is that the cover-up now really begins, because there's no way, I think, to characterize this than to say that Ferry pretty much lied his head off to the FBI about everything. And it's not so much that he did that, but what's really weird about this is that the FBI just accepted it. So this is, you know, one of the most fascinating things that I think is in my book. Let me give you some examples. Ferry said that he never owned a rifle, that he never owned a rifle with a scope, and for me, the clincher, that he wouldn't even know how to use a rifle with a scope. And what makes that so stupid, of course, is that if you read my book, Ferry was a trainer for both the Bay of Pigs and Mongoose. So how could he possibly not know how to do that? Why would the CIA hire him in the first place?
Jim, I'd like to bookmark that particular point of information. When we get
page 177.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, when we get to the things that were found in David Ferry's apartment, we'll leave that as an element of suspense. But Ferry claimed he'd never owned a rifle with a scope, and that he wouldn't even know how to use a rifle.
Right, right. Okay, now, some of the other things he said during this interview is that he said that he did not know Oswald, and Oswald was not a member of his Civil Air Patrol squadron in New Orleans, all right? Now, that, of course, is another couple of lies, all right? Because he did know Oswald, and Oswald was a member of his Civil Air Patrol unit. And in fact, and this is where we begin to see that the FBI simply had no interest in solving the Kennedy assassination. Because as this is going on, Ferry is secretly trying to find the evidence that will link him with Oswald. He's trying to find it, locate it, isolate it and eliminate it. He was calling people in New Orleans and asking them if they had that picture. So he, this picture, by the way, was finally shown on national television in 1993 on a PBS special program, Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald? And it had been around for 30 years, all right? And we're supposed to believe the FBI and the media could never find this picture, all right? So in addition to that, there were several people in New Orleans who could have testified to the fact that Ferry and Oswald knew each other from the Civil Air Patrol, all right? Now, here's my question. It's a felony to lie to the FBI under oath, all right? When you swear out an affidavit, that's the equivalent of an oath, all right? It would have taken J. Edgar Hoover about 1 or 2 days to collect the evidence that would have proved that Ferry was lying, all right, on multiple counts, all right? And this, of course, is the way that you crack a conspiracy, is you get somebody near the low end of the conspiracy, which Ferry was, and you charge him with multiple counts of perjury, and you threaten to throw him in jail unless he tells the truth, all right? Well, Hoover had a perfect opportunity to do that here, all right? And as I wrote in my book, I said, if anything shows us that the FBI was not interested in finding out who Oswald really was and who actually killed Kennedy, it's their failure to follow up on this interview, all right? So this, I believe, is really not just a milestone in the progress of the Kennedy case, but it's like a kind of flare in the sky showing us that nobody in Washington at this time had any interest at all of really solving what had happened in Dallas.
And even Ferry was not only lying, Jim, but even the most superficial element of his story, that he drove all night through a driving rainstorm to Houston or Galveston to go ice skating. I mean, yes. There was no closer place to go ice skating. and that he wanted to go goose hunting but brought no firearms with him. I sometimes have wondered whether perhaps the reference to a hunting expedition may have been a sort of an in-joke about the killing of Kennedy, but that's neither here nor there. The point being that just the most superficial element of what Ferry had to say is absurd, and no law enforcement officer with half a brain could possibly fail to see that he was lying and then proceed to begin searching for the truth.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
So, yeah, and we've spoken in the past about how Oswald was actually a member of Dave Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit. You might want to review very briefly some of the things we spoke about there with I've forgotten the name of the Mississippi Air Base that which they would go on their camperies there.
Keesler Air Force Base.
Yeah, it certainly appears that the direction that Oswald's life was to take was in many ways cast in that initial relationship with Ferry and through via the CAP.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think because Ferry was not just your run-of-the-mill CAP leader. He had a really strong influence on the guys in his Civil Air Patrol. All right, he would take him on these bivouacs on the weekend over to Keesler Air Force Base in Mississippi. And right there, that shows you that he was connected. You don't get to do that kind of stuff unless you have information, number one, and number two, clearance Okay, number two, to take, you know, a whole fleet of cadets over to a military base, all right, and have them stay there over the weekend in tents, et cetera, you know, that has, you have to have a clearance. And also, another one of the guys in that Civil Air Patrol said that FARA used to take them to air shows on military planes. On military planes. This shows you again just how special, all right, and just how highly thought of that David FARA was in the food chain. You know, he was essentially passing these guys on and preparing them for futures in the military. And that's why he had all of these secret privileges.
Indeed. Jim, one of the things you note in your book is that immediately after the assassination, David FARA was very anxious about some things, including pictures and that we've already alluded to, and also his library card. Develop that for us, if you would.
FARA was absolutely obsessed with the fact that maybe he had lent Oswald his library card. And he was actually starting to call people. Did I leave my library? Because evidently he couldn't find it. And so he started to call people about if he had left his library card at somebody's house. All right, so in addition to the picture, there was also this evidently forlorn library card that somehow FARA couldn't find. All right, now, so this is what I'm trying to say. People who are innocent and have nothing more than a casual involvement with someone or some event, you know, they don't do things like this. As the famous lawyer Allard Lowenstein said in regard to the Bobby Kennedy assassination, you know, he said, my experience as a lawyer is that people who don't have anything to hide don't hide things. Okay, and of course the corollary would be people who do have things to hide do hide things, all right? So that's what I believe in these early days after the assassination. You know, I think FARA was trying to hide things in order to go ahead and not get caught in this web that he evidently thought he was a part of. See, what they call this in the legal trade, especially in criminal cases, is something called, a term called consciousness of guilt. Okay?
Absolutely.
Right.
Jim, a lot of people might be wondering, well, you know, library card, what relevance might that have? You made a reference in one of our earlier interviews to micro dots, and I wonder if you would review that. Some researchers have opined that very possibly that a reference to micro dots that Oswald had in one of his journals or something, a letter, might have had something to do with the FARA and the library card.
No, well, Oswald actually explained the whole micro dot technology to a friend of his, a Jagger-Shiles Stovall. So in addition to the fact that if Oswald had FARA's library card, it would show an association, there might have been messages in that you can actually shrink down through photographic equipment back then into a period or a question mark, all right? And that might reveal something, I mean, a connection between the two, all right? So there were, in other words, there was all kinds of stuff to investigate with this, you know, with these revelations, all kinds, all right? And any real FBI investigator, if you know the way the FBI really works, when they want to solve a case, they can solve a case, all right? All right, but evidently they simply weren't interested. And I guess one way of indicating that is that on Friday, Kennedy was assassinated, all right? This, of course, was a once-in-a-century kind of a thing. So you would think if the FBI was really interested, Hoover would be calling in all these agents for overtime work He'd be right in his office with Tolson. They'd be manning the phones, having messengers working overtime. All right. Well, none of that happened. On Saturday, J. Edgar Hoover was at the racetrack. And That's how much he cared about Kennedy being killed.
There is also a story there that ever so briefly many researchers have chronicled that Hoover himself had profound links to organized crime, including Frank Costello, and they basically fixed some races for his behalf. But that is tangential under the circumstances. But again, a lot of people may be wondering, well, so what? He lent Oswald his library card. That may have been part of the intelligence relationship between the two.
But Dave, it wasn't just that. See, the other thing that Ferry would have had to explain, if some kind of association was revealed, is this. Mr. Ferry, everyone knows about your rather extreme right-wing beliefs, all right? And you're actually being kind of anti-Castro. What were you doing hanging out with a leftist communist who was pro-Castro?
And a defector and traitor. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
See, how would Ferry have answered that question? Yeah.
Well, he could not have given an honest answer. Maybe with, so I'm training him to go ice skating and goose hunting with no gun. But, you know, it is something, you know, the relationship between them is profound. Now, we've spoken about Ferry in connection with the anti-Castro Cuban activities of CIA, Mongoose, etc. If you would detail for us somewhat in review Ferry's activities at the Lacombe training camp and some of the individuals and elements with whom he came in contact in that type of activity.
All right. After the failure of the Bay of Pigs, all right, the administration decided to ramp up something called Operation Mongoose, all right? Mongoose was a kind of secret war, all right, against Cuba, all right? And so, therefore, it had a lot of military and CIA connections running that, right? And one of the things that was involved was training camps for Mongoose in and around the New Orleans area, right? And David Ferry was part of this effort. In fact, he actually told one of his friends, he called it Operation Mosquito. You know, clearly it was a mistake in translation, right? Because it was really Operation Mongoose. So he knew the code name of it, right? And the secret training camps included sites in Louisiana, all right? And one was at Lacombe, which is across huge Lake Pontchartrain, directly northwest of New Orleans. Bannister was reportedly at that camp also, and he reportedly got funds to finance it, all right? And it was on land owned by a guy named Bill McClaney, who was an old business friend of Jack Ruby's, all right? As I said, Ferry was an instructor at that camp. That camp got raided by the FBI in the summer of 1963, all right, and they took all kinds of explosives and weapons out of it, all right, and the FBI had been tipped off to validate violations of what we call the Neutrality Act, and they proceeded on orders from the White House to go ahead and raid it, all right, and this was, of course, as you mentioned earlier, this was part of Kennedy's efforts to wind down, okay, things. right, in 1963 and de-escalate in Cuba, right? And it was part of a pledge that he had made to Khrushchev after the missile crisis, right? All right, now, so one of the backers of Lacombe, there is some evidence that it was actually, because, see, what happened is, once the CIA started cutting back and being, you know, busted by the FBI, they had to get the money from other sources, right? And so there is some evidence that they went to these eccentric right-wingers, millionaire right-wingers, like the Hunt brothers, okay, to go ahead and find some of this money. And there is some information that that's where some of the money was coming in for this Lacombe place, right? Now, what makes this even more interesting...
Jim, 1 second. That is from Texas oil man H.L. Hunt.
H.L. Hunt, yes.
It's interesting that this is a pattern that endured throughout the decades among the, quote, private, unquote, backers of the Contra support effort in the 1980s was Nelson Bunker Hunt, his son. So
right.
this is a pattern we have seen. Now, back to H.L. Hunt, back to the Lacombe camp and Ferry, and the background against which the camp was raided and decommissioned, and the context being Kennedy's rapprochement with Castro, bearing in mind who Ferry was, what he was doing, and how this would have, or not would have, but how it affected him.
Right. See, when this starts happening, all right, then Ferry starts to start raging against JFK in both private and in public. One time he had to actually been taken off a stage, all right, at some kind of military alumni meeting, because he got so vituperative towards Kennedy, all right, and he actually then began to actually talk about plotting to kill Kennedy, all right, but he most of that time he would do it in the second or third person, not himself, and so. What that happens is that when Garrison started digging into this, in addition to the whole Perry Russo meeting, all right, Garrison began to find other things which indicated that Ferry was doing more than just raging against Kennedy. You know, he was actually plotting, all right, to get rid of Kennedy. And this is some of the things I found in the Jim Garrison declassified files by the ARB. I don't remember seeing this anywhere else, all right? And Garrison had planted an informer on Ferry, okay, in 1967, and he came up with something called the bomb, which looked like a plot to get rid of Castro at this time. But then Garrison found a witness who said that in the wake of JFK's assassination, right, she had heard that Garrison was questioning Ferry, and she knew Ferry, and went down to G. Ray Gill's office, who was a lawyer who Ferry worked for, and went over to his desk, and she said that she found what looked like a map of Dealey Plaza in his desk, all right? And then one of the secretaries came over, and she got into a tug-of-war contest because she wanted to take it out of the office, but she ended up losing the contest. But she remembered by looking at the diagram that it said Elm Street, which, of course, is the street where Kennedy was killed on in Dallas, all right? So these are the kind of things that Garrison was turning up during his investigation, which nobody, and I mean nobody, ever reported on.
So now, again, something that was nicknamed The Bomb, ostensibly a plan by Ferry to assassinate Fidel Castro. But
right.
When the details were developed, actually it was something that appeared to have been scheduled for and positioned at Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Jim, you mentioned briefly Perry Russo. This is a name we have not brought up to date. We'll come back to that in the trial, but perhaps it might be useful for the benefit of the audience for you to tell us who Perry Russo was and his significance for Garrison's case against Ferry. We'll come back to that later in future interviews.
Okay. Russo was one of the witnesses that Garrison had who said that he heard Ferry and Shaw talking about an assassination plot against the president. And he ended up being one of the witnesses that Garrison produced at the trial.
We'll talk about what happened or the treatment he received from various people later.
Right, yes.
We've spoken about Ferry in earlier interviews in the context of the anti-Castro Cuban activities and, of course, the bomb, ostensibly anti-Castro, but may actually have been a plan Ferry was helping to design for Dealey Plaza. Two names that we have discussed previously in connection with the CIA's anti-Castro activities. And I wonder if you would tell us about the links of both Eladio Del Valle and Sergio Arcacha Smith to David Ferry.
All right. Both of those men, Eladio Del Valle and Sergio Arcacha Smith, had been kind of high up officials in the Batista government, right? I think Del Valle was a congressman and Sergio Arcacha Smith was a kind of diplomat, all right? And as time went on, and they did not feel that Castro's designs were everything that they thought they were going to be, that they decided to go ahead and leave Cuba to go to the United States. And both men got involved with the State Department and the CIA's efforts in the anti-Castro underground within America. Now, Sergio Arcacha Smith worked in New Orleans and was one of the people who frequented Guy Bannister's office. He eventually moved to Dallas, I think, in 62, but he would come back and visit New Orleans every once in a while. He's a very, very interesting character, to put it mildly, all right? And we'll get back to him later, as they say, the plot thickens. Eladio Del Valle was also a favorite of the CIA, and particularly Senator George Smathers from Florida, all right? And he was involved in flying missions with Ferry, okay, in order to bomb certain targets in Cuba, all right? And he actually was involved in paying Ferry for some of these missions that he was involved in.
So this, again, what Ferry was doing in connection with the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban operations, and that again against the background of Kennedy's attempted diplomatic rapprochement with Castro, which would have made him, that would have been a death sentence for an awful lot of these people toward Kennedy and the CIA as a whole. When Garrison began pursuing his investigation of Ferry and began uncovering not only the links we've spoken of, but in Jim's book as lengthy, to the audience, as lengthy and admittedly pedantic as this approach to Destiny Betrayed is, I want to underscore that there is an awful lot more than we will be able to cover on the air. So that's why at the end of the program and at the ends of previous interviews, I have encouraged people to buy the book. And there are still six more shopping days till Christmas. So people can go ahead and do that. Jim, when Garrison began to look into Ferry and his, my favorite word, milieu, and came across the things we have been speaking about, Ferry began reacting in a very extreme fashion. Tell us about how Ferry reacted and what, in your opinion, his reactions really betokened.
Well, when Garrison went ahead and returned to the JFK case in the fall of 1966 and in the spring of 1967, Ferry had a kind of, let's say, manic reaction. In private, he feared for his life, okay? And then in public, he leaked all these kinds of discrediting stories about Jim Garrison to the press, all right? He finally, in a conversation with Lou Ivan, very close to the time where he passed away, he did make certain admissions about working for the CIA and also knowing who Clay Shaw was. In fact, there's so much evidence now that, you know, and I put it in the book, that Shaw and Ferry and Bannister all knew each other and all worked with each other, that to me, you know, it's kind of nutty to even try and deny that that's the case in these days. But they did. There's no doubt about it. And that finally, the other thing I should add is that Oswald was in Bannister's office. There's no question about that, of course, today also. And, you know, and like I said earlier, how are these guys going to explain that? You know, what the heck was Oswald, this alleged communist, doing in the middle of all these right-wing Cuban exiles and right-wing nuts, like, you know, I think it's the only way you can do word to describe Guy Bannister. Okay, he was an extreme right-winger, right, to the point that he was a kind of violent kind of a person, right?
He was. Now, Jim, I'd like to just interject. I think, and this is not to find fault with you or your analysis, but I think in terms of the understanding of the audience, I think characterizing what they did as psychopathological is perhaps inaccurate in that they really were not mentally ill. They were fascists. These were not people who were hallucinating. These were murderous, highly ideologized right-wingers. And they had an agenda, and they were bloody well, and I mean that literally, going to realize that agenda. So I think in terms of the point you made is excellent. What is Oswald doing in the middle of people like David Ferry, Guy Bannister, the Marxist Marine, you know, doing all of the things that he did? None of it makes any sense unless one looks upon his ostensible activities as an intelligence cover. David Ferry, you made the point earlier, Jim, about the legal principle of consciousness of guilt. In connection with David Ferry, his violent statements toward Kennedy and the strange way he reacted, you know, attacking Garrison in public and then expressing fear for his life in private. How do you think that relates to the consciousness of guilt principle?
Yeah, well, in my opinion, Ferry had all the indications of a man on the edge who was about to break. you know. And, you know, in my opinion also, I think that Garrison probably made a mistake, you know, in not indicting David Ferry. Because I think we all know what happened, of course. He turned up dead under rather suspicious, to put it mildly, you know, circumstances. I mean, how many people die of a Barry aneurysm leaving two suicide notes on the unsigned suicide notes, by the way, on the coffee table in front of them?
Yeah,
you know, rather an unusual happenstance.
Yeah.
In fact, I was talking to the coroner who took over, and he said something like that had never happened in the history of the city. It was so weird.
I mean, he left two unsigned typed suicide notes and yet supposedly died of a, quote, Barry aneurysm at the base of his brain. And that dog won't go ice skating, I guess we could say.
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about the circumstances about surrounding Ferry's death. In particular, I thought it was very interesting that we see George Lardner, who figures decades later in connection with the Oliver Stone film. But tell us about George Lardner and his activities vis-a-vis David Ferry at around this time.
All right. The coroner in New Orleans had originally said that Ferry had passed away at around 11 o'clock to midnight, all right? And Lardner then popped up and said, well, I kind of doubt that for the simple reason that I was there, okay, until the wee hours of the morning, around three or four. Now, that's kind of interesting because if such was the case, then that would have meant that if Ferry was murdered, then they had to be waiting for Lardner to leave. They had to be waiting, like, right outside or across the street from the apartment that Ferry lived in. So that's an interesting kind of angle into, you know, perhaps some of the circumstances under which Ferry was killed, right? Now, see, something that was not commonly known is, and was only known at the time that Oliver Stone's film was released, is that there were markings in the inside of Ferry's mouth, all right, that were rather discernible and were easily notable to any medical examination, except they're not in the autopsy report, which is kind of bizarre, all right? But it's very evident by looking at the photos, and this was done by Minyard, who is the coroner now, and also Cyril Wecht, all right? Another famous coroner from Pittsburgh, all right? And so this led Garrison to think that maybe somebody jammed a solution down Ferry's mouth forcibly, okay? All right? And, you know, that would be one way, of course, to do it. All right, now,
You mentioned
Garrison,
Jim. Let me
Garrison,
just,
go ahead.
Briefly, you also go into some of Ferry's prescriptions and how that might have figured in connection with those marks in David Ferry's mouth. I wonder if you would develop that for us briefly for the benefit of the audience.
Okay. As I described the scene, the table next to his body was strewn with medicine bottles, and several of them were empty. Garrison took some of the medicine bottles in order to check them out. All right. Okay. And one of the medicine bottles was something called Proloid, all right? And this was done, I guess, to relieve Ferry's hypertension, all right? And Garrison did some research on this, and found out that this drug could cause death by brain aneurysm without leaving any traces, right? Now, please, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm not saying that's what happened. All I'm saying is that there were circumstances there, okay, that would make that possible, right?
Sure.
Now, remember what we said about Ferry saying that there was he had no experience with firearms? Or, well, take a look at what was in his apartment.
Yeah, Jim, I'd like to read.
Okay, go ahead.
what they found when they went into David Ferry's apartment, from page 225. The contents of Ferry's apartment at the time of his death were unusual for a private investigator. I love your writing there, your understatement. They included a blue 100. It's hard to read this. It reminds me of the Nietzschean phrase, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. I find it hard to read this without laughing. It's not ha, 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 but... Once again, the contents of Ferry's apartment at the time of his death were unusual for a private investigator. They included a blue 100-pound aerial bomb, a Springfield rifle, a Remington rifle, an altered stock, a .22 rifle, 20 shotgun shells, two Army Signal Corps telephones, one bayonet, one flare gun, a radio transmitter unit, a radio receiver unit, 32 rifle cartridges, 22 blanks, several cameras, and three rolls of film. And by the way, his body was found naked in the living room,
right,
which is not in and of itself neither here nor there. But this, again, in the apartment of someone who claimed he didn't know how to shoot a gun.
Right.
And obviously, having sort of a mini arsenal of that kind in one's apartment is absolutely consistent with Ferry's role as a paramilitary instructor for a mongoose at the Lacombe site, etc., and the things we've spoken about.
Right.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
George Lardner, in addition to his behavior vis-a-vis Ferry, surfaced decades later in conjunction with the Oliver Stone film JFK in the early 90s. Tell us about that, Jim.
Right. Well, this is really interesting. As we know today, Oliver Stone purchased the rights to Jim Garrison's book On the Trail of the Assassins, and he went ahead and wrote a script, co-wrote a script with Zach Sklar, then went into production for the film. All right? While he was in production for the film, the word got out that this is what's happening, and George Lardner ended up in Dallas on the scene of Oliver Stone making his movie. All right? And he stayed there a few days, and then he wrote a hit piece article, all right, which I believe was in the middle of June. It was that article was written and published in the middle of June 1991, which would make it about 6 months before the film was released. And it was an attack on Garrison, on Stone, on the film's thesis that somehow Kennedy was withdrawing from Vietnam and that Johnson reversed that. Okay, everything about the film. And so Oliver, of course, wanted to reply, right? And so he had to get his public relations guy, Frank Mankiewicz, to talk to Ben Bradley, who was the editor, still the editor at that time, and they were resisting giving Oliver an opportunity to reply. So Oliver had to threaten to buy an ad in a newspaper to get what he wanted to say in. All right, and so finally, Bradley said, "Okay, fine. Okay, we'll let you go ahead and reply to the hit piece," and that's how we got it in. That's how bad the major media is. You know, even Oliver Stone had trouble getting a letter to the editor into the Washington Post. You know, so forget if it was me or you. It wasn't going to happen. You know?
Several things in connection with that. In a future interview, we will be going into the extraordinary behavior of media people such as George Lardner. And I think, Jim, as I've said off the air to you, there is no more important part of the many important parts of Destiny Betrayed for people here in the tail end of 2018 than the behavior of the media, what I have said over the decades, the transmogrification of the Fourth Estate into a fifth column, where they're not really reporting the news, but rather they are taking an activist approach to covering that up. You know, in connection also with George Lardner and his curious behavior in connection with Ferry's death. And then he goes down to Dallas and he's hanging out and then publishes a hit piece on Garrison, on Oliver Stone's film, also on Garrison, but before the release of the movie, the principle you enunciated before of consciousness of guilt, I think, needs to be weighed in connection with Lardner's behavior. Not that it was necessarily decisive in that context, but I think that is instructive. Also in connection with Ben Bradley and the Washington Post, there is a very important book by Deborah Davis called Catherine the Great about Catherine Graham. And she talks about the Washington Post, Newsweek, and the whole Graham publishing empire and its decades-long relationship with the CIA. So keep that in mind. David Ferry, you know, died under very strange circumstances, and Eladio Del Valle bit the farm shortly afterward. Tell us about that, Jim.
Oh, okay. That was, I think, within 24 hours of Ferry's death, Eladio Del Valle was found dead in Miami. And Garrison sent an investigator to scope it out. And he left a note for Garrison saying that Eladio Del Valle's body was found murdered gangland style, you know, that is, with a knife and a bullet wound, within the immediate vicinity of Bernardo de Torres' apartment. Now, what makes that interesting, of course, is Bernardo de Torres was one of the guys who was involved in the Bay of Pigs operation. All right, a very heavy hitter in the Cuban exile community who had infiltrated Garrison's investigation just a few months before. Okay? So this is the kind of thing you were hinting at, which you want to talk about later, about how awful the media was in covering Garrison's inquiry. And also how Garrison's inquiry was massively infiltrated by saboteurs and agents who wanted to go ahead and make sure that it capsized. That's an upcoming hint for what we're going to talk about later.
Absolutely. And in that regard, the previously enunciated principle of consciousness of guilt, I think, as we'll see, warrants application in a broader, deep political and institutional context. You know, if David Ferry was innocent and Clay Shaw was innocent and Garrison was just a hyper-ambitious, homophobic, mob-associating so-and-so, why was all of this very heavy journalistic and hands-on counterintelligence artillery deployed against him? You know, it is more than a little interesting. You mentioned it previously with Bernardo de Torres. He also appeared, may very well have been in Beale Plaza and had links with Mitchell Rebell, as I recall.
Correct.
And that
Bernardo de Torres was being investigated by the House Select Committee, and one of the informants that they recruited said that de Torres reportedly had pictures of Dealey Plaza in a safe deposit box, and he later went to work at a company, I think, called Military Armaments Corporation with the legendary Mitch Rebell, who I'm sure your listeners know, but maybe we should say it anyway, was a kind of eccentric genius when it came to devising all kinds of rifles and sniper weapons and revolvers and pistols. And he was really a brilliant, brilliant weapons designer for the CIA. Okay, so kind of an odd place for Bernardo to work out.
Rebell had the nickname the Wizard of Whispering Death, alluding to his innovations in silenced machine guns and also the Thomas Edison of silenced weaponry.
Right.
He is best known as the designer of the Ingram Mach-10 and Mach-11 silenced machine pistols, which actually people may have seen in movies. And this, again, should be borne in mind, the links with David Ferry, the fact that David Ferry dies of, you know, take your pick, a prolloid poisoning, a berry aneurysm at the base of the brain. But then why are there two typed suicide notes in his apartment? What were those lesions on the inside of David Ferry's mouth? And what was George Lardner doing, the little Tinkerbell of journalism, hovering about David Ferry at a very, very interesting time, and then flitting down to Beale Plaza, down to Dallas, Texas, and hovering about Oliver Stone decades later?
Right.
And I don't think that Eladio Del Valle's death could be attributed to prolloid poisoning or suicide. He was found shot through the heart, tortured, and with his head split open by a machete.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the berry aneurysm in his brain was caused by a machete. So that was the end of him. And that was within 24 hours of David Ferry's death. So that is very interesting indeed. Jim, we've got about 2 minutes left. Before we carry this narrative forward in our next interview, listeners can buy not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK The Evidence Today and pursue other information on your website and also hear you on Black Op Radio. Tell them about that.
All right. The website that I publish at is called KennedysandKing.com. And if you go ahead and click there, you'll be able to see ways that you can buy Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, which is the book we're talking about, and my more recent book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. I'm also a semi-regular guest on Leno Sanek's show out of Vancouver called Black Op Radio.
All righty. And as I said, you know, here we are on December 18th. Certainly one need not purchase Destiny Betrayed as a holiday gift. I think it would make an excellent holiday gift. If the holidays pass and people hear this after that, buy it anyway, and I get no money whatsoever from this situation. But this would make an excellent holiday gift for a thinking, reading, and politically attuned individual on your holiday shopping list. So that is something to do, and some places to go, Black Op Radio and Kennedys and King. And we will be resuming continue our dive into the murky and treacherous waters being explored by Jim Garrison in our next interview. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1040, interview number 9 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2018. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying, Thanks for listening.